So Gautam, to start with, you often have said that your mother is a mother who never said no.
Yes.
And so what was it like to have a mother who never said no?
You see, I would not know anything else. So what is interesting is, I thought everyone's mother never said no to their children, because my frame of reference was my mother. So there was no policing. There was no domination. There was hardly any control. You know, I feel, because my mother mentioned that when my father passed away, at that time he was running a flourishing ad agency, and she had to take charge, being a housewife with absolutely no experience, zero. So the day when she had to go and sit in his chair, she said that she told Shiva, "You have brought me this far. Now it is up to you. I will just go and sit in the chair. Thereafter, what happens is your responsibility." So my sense is that even in bringing up three children, I was 14, my sister was 16, and the other sister was 17. It must have been such a daunting task for someone who has lost their husband, who has no clue about business, to not only bring up the children emotionally, but financially ensure a stable environment with no background experience. So this quality, I think, of entrusting it to Shiva is perhaps what she also did in this case. Now, by nature, I remember her always as a gentle and quiet personality. I have never seen her scream and shout. At most, get a bit irritated. You see, so it is only in the later years one realizes the value of such an upbringing. Now, when my guru, Ramesh Balsekar, would tell parents that they need to understand that their children have their own destiny and not force their worldview and point of view on their kids, now I see how in my case, we were all as siblings allowed to become who we are, because there was no hand of suppression, aggression, control, domination, and so on. And so that's the best way I can explain when you asked me, how does it feel like to have grown up with a mother who never said no? How does it feel like? I remember in my teenage years, the first time I had alcohol, I came home, my head was spinning as soon as I lay down, so I had to go to the bathroom to puke. And she just stood, the bathroom door was open, she just stood behind me, asked if I was okay, and went back to her room. That is it. So you see, this kind of silent presence is what we have as children been graced with. The value of these things is not known when one is in one's teenage years. As one grows older, these realizations come.
Was there ever a time when she kind of said, not no outright, but steered you in a different direction? You have spoken about how with your first paycheck you wanted to invest it in the stock market. So can you tell us about that?
See, she mostly exercised a word of caution, but she never said, don't do this. Now, it's a tricky thing because we tend to ignore words of caution unless we are told, don't do this. But I remember that, you know, when you're young, you want to make money fast.
Yeah.
And so I had a friend whose brother was in the stockbroking business and who said, oh, we're going to make good money. And the first amount I earned, I put that whole thing in. And of course, lost it. So again, I think she trusted that whatever lessons needed to be learned would be learned. And it didn't need her intervention beyond a point. And honestly, I feel this is how the guru functions. The guru will not tell their disciple, do this and don't do this. Some do. Some gurus do that. It depends on the stream, the parampara they belong to, the kind of, if they are into a kriya yoga, the kriya which is given, no doubt. But in terms of life guidance, even my guru never said, do this and don't do that. He gave suggestions. Now, it is up to the student, the disciple, to follow the suggestions. That takes awareness. Because you see, the personal will is so strong that we feel we know best.
Yeah.
So, it's quite an important point that I feel any guide, whether you call it a guru, a guide, a parent, whatever it be, the right thing is to suggest. Because see, they know they cannot play God. They know they don't know best. They trust the divine will. So suggestions are given. And that is what happened in this case. So at various stages, when I would ask her about my publishing company, other aspects of life also, relationships, she would never say, this person is right for you, this person is wrong for you. This business is right, this business is wrong. She would just give suggestions. And I think we have imbibed that by and large, at least in my case. Whenever I have been asked, I have only given suggestions. Whether the person listens or not is God's will.
You were talking about your mom and then you talked about her as guru.
Yes.
So, can you say more about that?
In her case specifically, you see, she was the most unlikely guru. She had her spiritual awakening in the year 1995. And it took 3 years. It was a process of 3 years of spiritual unfoldment, where she had a lot of visions of the subtle realms, the higher realms, and so on and so forth. And this all happened while her guru, Justice Dudat, was in the body. Then, with the march of time, he dropped his body, and she found, after some amount of time, people started coming to her. It was a natural course of evolution as far as her journey was concerned. She had no interest to be a guru. She still does not consider herself a guru in the strictest sense, but those who follow her consider themselves as her disciples or students. So, but you see, I feel why I resonated with Rameshji's teaching that everything is predetermined. I will read out a letter when my mother's first book was out on her experiences. We met a Nath yogi called Gagangiri Nath Maharaj. He was in Khapoli. His ashram is there. His samadhi is there. It's a flourishing ashram. And when she had this body of work, which was nothing but simple drawings. She was not a trained artist. So they were like sketches of what she saw happening in the process of awakening. She was wondering whether to share this with people or not? Because many people said this is all occult and hidden knowledge, it should not be shared. But I think it was her innocence, because she had no conscious background of the subject, that she felt if someone else was going through a similar experience, they could have a reference point. Now, with that intent, we went to Gagangiri Maharaj. When he saw those drawings, we could not speak the same language because he spoke Marathi, we didn't speak Marathi, so there was an interpreter there. He started laughing like a child. He would flip the pages and keep laughing and pointing out things and saying stuff in Marathi. But it was really delightful to see this happening. It was so out of context, you see. So I'm going to read out the letter he gave, which we published in her first book, which proves that all this comes from the past. You know, so my point is, people who are obsessed with free will think that they are in full control of their lives and also their spiritual awakening. If they just learn to relax and release and trust the divine will, then what is scripted is allowed to happen.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read this out. This is dated 9th July 1998. Guru Purnima. The dreamlike visions presented by Santosh Sachdeva in this book are very good, and they represent the blessings of the masters to this generation. Tapasvis like Mahavatar Babaji, who have been engaged in ascetic practices for hundreds of years in the mountains in India, can thus enlighten any jiva. Yet, there are hundreds of thousands of beings to choose from, and at least thousands of sadhus who can be so blessed. The reason for her being singled out for this honor is that she too has been a part of the stream of sadhus life after life. And this is the culmination of her own punya karma involving hundreds of years of sadhana. Every single atom of her body has become receptive to the teachings of the masters, and this book is the result. This is a rarest of rare occurrences, a Mahadurlabh yoga in the physical world. I suggest, therefore, that she diligently continue this practice to illustrate the workings of the Kundalini. So, to just allow this unfolding on the spiritual journey, rather than thinking we can control it. In her case, it was very clear. It had to happen. And she went with the flow. But this going with the flow requires trust and surrender.
Yeah.
Which I realized later on are very rare commodities.
Did her not saying no also give you the ability to trust whatever was coming up for you in your life and going with the flow?
Perhaps in a way, because it became my conditioning. But I think basically, although the parampara, the path I follow is the path of Advaita. The blessings are all from the Shakti. You see, for example, when I began the book publishing company, Yogi Impressions, it began with my mother's first book. So that same Shakti, which you could say looked after me, resulted in her awakening, resulted in the first book.
Mm.
So it really begets the question, this is for everyone, not just me, I'm not special in any way, that whatever we do, wherever we are in life, we can see that the hand of God is behind it, because where we are is shaped by our past, mm. by our conditioning. Mm. And to acknowledge that, to accept that, it can make one go a very far way.
Mm.
Rather than all this personal striving, mm. angst, frustration.
Mm.
You see, so in both the cases, whether it was Rameshji or my mother, you could say two of the main characters for me in this living dream of life, both said the same thing, let life flow.
You have mentioned also before that in many times on talks and on your website and in your writings that you also followed your mother in doing the course that she did with Justice to That.
Yes.
And how was that? And around the same time you met Rameshji.
Yes.
So how are those two streams of, I don't know what to call it, coming together for you? Was it difficult to integrate it, or was it?
See, luckily I was naive.
Mm.
I didn't question too much. So it happened very naturally. Now, you see, the thing is, I had a very rigid work schedule in my advertising days. I would reach the office at 9:45 a.m. Thrice a week, I would come home at 1 a.m. in the night. And the other days by 7:30. So I was yearning for a break.
Hmm.
Now, when Justice to That had his classes on Brahma Vidya, literally down the road at KC College. And they were on Wednesdays. So my logical mind kicked in. It said, I need a break. Why not midweek break? And why not on Wednesdays leave office little earlier, go and sit there, and then walk home? So it was a perfect fit. And I can't say I enjoyed the classes. It was a very long course. Mm. It was 8 months. Mm. See, that is another thing. People today don't want to do serious sadhana. They want quick fixes. So anyway, this was a long course. So some classes were engaging. Some I got a bit bored in. It depended on the content of each class.
Mm.
But because my nature was to be disciplined, I didn't really miss much. Mm-hmm. I never felt, oh, I should not go today.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was very lucky that these thoughts never came.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, if there was something else, someone was in town and visiting and there was no other day to meet them, certainly I would do that. But I would say by and by, I didn't miss these classes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a course of breathwork, because it is a kriya that deals with the descending energy. But at the same time, it's called Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of Brahman. So all the text matter, the affirmations which it had, which are not quite different from what affirmations are referred to today. Like, for example, a line is, I and the Creator are one. So that's very different, right, from manifesting your dream car or bungalow or something. So we had to learn these by heart. So in that learning by heart, I think a lot of learning happened. Because, you know, then the mind automatically wants to understand what is going on. I am the creative spirit. The Creator is right here, right in the heart of me, right in the mind of me. So when I was learning the course, I was not overthinking. There was a course, just like you do history, geography in school, you read it, you study it, same process. Later on, this kind of merging happened beautifully. See, breath work is of tremendous help. in clearing the subtle channels of the body, which are clogged with toxins, with negative thinking, with issues carried lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. Now, people on the path of Advaita say, oh, no techniques are required and so on and so forth. But like Ramakrishna, did they have the awakening of the Kundalini? Most likely not. When Ramana Maharshi said, when he was asked about the energy in the body, that it is like a mad elephant in a thatched hut. What was he referring to? The energy, the Shakti. So thank God, I was not straitjacketed. I was open as a default setting. I didn't try to be open. I was open. So that was going side by side. Then Justice Dudath would conduct his weekly meditations in this very room for many years. So as and when I could, I would come and attend the meditation. So it became kind of conditioning which grew slowly and steadily, by and by. And that is how it evolved, one could say. So I had no conflict. I knew the role which this had to play in my life, the role which Advaita had to play. And there have been many influences in my life, as most people who follow the talks know. There's not just Advaita. There's this, my mother's past, my mother's background, the Kundalini path. Then I have a big influence of the Nath tradition. Not that I have studied the Nath scriptures or been initiated into the Shabri mantras or anything. But I have this natural affinity and somehow land up at places associated with the Naths across the land. So there are all these influences, and I never denied any. Nor was I confused what is my path. My path was clear, you see. The minute I saw Siddharameshwar Maharaj's Samadhi in the cremation grounds of Banganga, at that point I knew this is the parampara I belong to. So, thank God, I always had clarity.
From what you're describing, it sounds like there's a fair bit of a detachedness with everything, perhaps. And this is part of your upbringing, and this is part of the personality of having a mother like Santosh Ma.
See, it's a very good point you have raised. Because when I see my mother and I see my guru, both didn't allow themselves to be a crutch to me. And as far as Rameshji is concerned, he just did not allow himself to be a crutch for anyone. Because you see, that creates dependency. The guru wants you to be independent. The guru does not want you to rely on the guru to run your house. They want what they have. They want to share that with others so that the others may see life through that lens. So you're quite right. In both cases, I think it led to a detachment, but I want to make clear this is not a cold detachment. This is more like not being attached to an individual because life is too scary. Life is too difficult. I have faced tremendous difficulties in my teenage years. I would not wish others to face them. Yet, I know there are those who've had worse difficulties. That's always the case. But this detachment is just the realization that everything in life is transient. As we all know from our own experience, things come and go. And so, witnessing the witness consciousness which my mother brought to my upbringing, my guru brought through his teaching, to be established in that, if that is called detachment, correct. But to re-emphasize, it is not a cold detachment where there is no love and warmth.
Yeah.
Because I have seen this also on the path of Gyan Yoga. People behave in a very cold manner. And it is not that. In fact, that could be a dysfunction. Because this detachment is the purest love. It is the purest love.
In relation to this, there's a incident of a friend, a family friend who passed away, and the sense of being calm in one moment and being very emotional in the next. This is something you have spoken about before. Would you say more?
This is about my mother when she attended a prayer service.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was about 10 years ago when a friend's wife had passed suddenly. We were holidaying, in fact, in the same place where we went on holiday with them when I was 12, 14 years old. So, my mother has never been one to display emotion as such. Not that she's suppressing it, it's just the way she is. So, I remember I took her to the home which is near our home. My father's closest friend, one of his closest friends, his wife had passed. So when we walked in, till then everything was fine. But as she went forward to put flowers at the portrait, she burst out crying. But it was an in the moment, like so spontaneous. And then in 2 minutes, she was back to who she was before entering that doorway, you see. Again, these have been such important pointers because there are no rules. Spontaneity is the key. Expression. Yet not mourning in the duration of time. So, once we were back home, she never kept on and on. She was not sobbing, not upset. It was done and dealt with. So I suppose this is really called, for me, enlightened living.
It may have been a little bit difficult with maybe friends and other people, peers in your life, seeing this relationship. Did they ever ask you questions or?
Not really, because they were not too much in this house, hanging out or something that they could closely see it. For them, I was the friend who lost his father, which was a rare occurrence in school and college. Mostly people's parents are there. So it was a kind of different thing as far as I was concerned.
How was Santosh Ma's awakening process, being around it, and what did you see and what was your experience of it?
So we saw nothing because she would close her door and she would say she's meditating, and we had no idea what that meant also. But we left her alone. So it's just that after her meditation, she would have these drawings which we could not figure out at that age, that how did closing the door result in that drawing and what's the whole thing? It just made no sense to us, which was perfect because we left her alone. But what happened was that once she was sufficiently through a journey, she started sharing this with like-minded people she knew, friends involved in the same subject, or even acquaintances. She knocked on many doors. They started coming home to discuss her drawings with her. So we started getting exposed to different kinds of people than the ones we normally knew. Different kind of people came home talking about these subjects. So once in a while, I would peek in, or I would come into the living room when the discussions were going on. And I found that this was something different. Now, I must have had this innate interest, because I remember since my early 20s, once I saw an ad for some aura reading class in the suburbs in Bandra. A foreigner was conducting it, so I went for that. Then someone else did Reiki, I went for that. So that was happening on the side. But what I noticed was this dimension somehow held some a magical quality to it, which was away from the mundane life. Mundane, okay, you're young, you go for movies with your friends, lunches, dinners, at that time the nightclubs, all that was going on. It was a very normal South Bombay life I led. But this was fun. This side was something which came as an add-on, and of course eventually took over. So again, it's thanks to that exposure of the people coming to meet her that these interests grew also. And all sorts of people, like I would meet some lovely people, they would talk to me about past lives and about which places I was drawn to, and then they would say why I'm drawn to them. And also it was a lot of learning, but in a pleasant way, in terms of discussion, engagement. And what is amusing is, I'll never forget, my friend's wife, they were going to one lady who was also into the healing arts at that time. And so this lady, somehow the discussion came up about my mother. So this lady told my friend's wife, "Oh, Santosh, I know her so well, she's so delightful because she's harmless, she absolutely has no ego." And I thought, what a funny thing to say also, she's so harmless. Because it actually means we are all programmed to believe people are out to harm us. So these things, these conversations, these sentences stayed with me. You know, so I'm pretty clear that in a way my whole journey has been one of the divine feminine, the Shakti, which has kind of delivered me to Advaita. That is what has happened. That is why recently on a trip to Kashmir, I have gotten to know a lady peer. Peer, you could say, is a Sufi master. And like my mother, she also has children. So she asked me one day to show me a photo, to show her a photo of my mother. So when she saw it, she told me, she said, she had known, her disciples had told her about my background, they've seen my videos and all that. She knows what I do. And she said very recently, she said, "Whatever he may say is fine, but all this is a gift from the womb." Which basically means one has come, anyone has come with whatever they've come with. And that is why this whole debate of free will and destiny is quite irrelevant, because actually both are just polaric opposites which cancel each other out. Ultimately, it's irrelevant. If one is aware that life is being played on the screen of consciousness, the polarities become irrelevant. The important point, which is why my teacher stressed on this, is because we are too conditioned to believe in a supreme free will of the individual. So to hammer that down, these concepts of destiny and all were brought in to prove to the ego very little is in your control. And what was nice was, my Guru never spoke about Kundalini. It was not his experience. And now my mother, he met on two or three occasions. Once when he came home, and she would come with me, I think on Guru Purnima or his birthday. At that time, she was not giving satsangs herself. So when people would ask Rameshji in satsang about energy and Kundalini experiences, he started referring them to her.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't just end that, it's not my experience, I can't help you. He would say that you go to Gautam's mother. Mm-hmm. Now, I would only go on Sundays,
mm-hmm.
but then someone would give the number, someone would call, so I would know that he had sent them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very nice kind of thing to witness, this mutual respect
mm-hmm.
for each other's paths.
Mm-hmm.
And I met people who were at Rameshji's satsang and they were sitting with my mother the next thing I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Because those who had interest in the subject and experiences to share,
mm-hmm.
delightful people. I remember one lady from Germany, she looked like a sadhu, she had jatas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she found Rameshji, came for satsang there. But eventually she had to land up here because hers was the path of spiritual visions and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And they had put her under medication in Germany, psychiatric medication. But when she realized that she was having a full-blown awakening, which in the East is called Kundalini awakening, everything fell into place.
Mm-hmm.
You see, here I'd like to add that my mother's journey has been unique because the Kundalini has been a friend to her.
Mm-hmm.
It has been gentle. There has been a lot of negative experiences shared about the Kundalini creating trouble. It is true because most pathways follow the ascending energy.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Kundalini, when it rises and it's unchecked, is going to push its way through the body-mind complex.
Mm.
So when there are blockages and we are mostly blocked, especially in the lower chakras where all the issues are stored, it's going to be a problem. So a lot of these courses which are not guided by a guru, which are weekend courses, which are all these haphazard ways of practice, and even the students conduct haphazard ways of practice.
Mm-hmm.
Then they complain. So there's a lot of scaremongering as far as the Kundalini is concerned. And it's justified in those cases.
Mm-hmm.
Hers was the opposite. So she had outlandish experiences. She had the White Brotherhood come to assist her, did surgery on her in the dream state, in the meditative state, reinscribed grooves of the brain. People would tell us that everyone will call your mother mad. Are you all prepared?
Mm-hmm.
I think we were prepared. It was irrelevant what people called us.
Mm-hmm.
You see, but the point is that her guru never gave her fear of the Kundalini. Guru never spoke about Kundalini. It was not his experience also.
Mm-hmm.
He was teaching the Brahma Vidya course.
Mm-hmm.
It is a Kriya Yoga. It is bound to create energy experiences in people who are receptive to energy,
mm-hmm.
which it did. But all he would do there is be there for her through her experience of awakening. And she had some challenging ones where she saw, I don't remember the experience clearly, that in her vision she thought her head was going to explode.
Mm-hmm.
So she immediately called up her guru after the morning meditation and said, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, so what's the problem? She said, I'm afraid. So he said, why? She said, because I will die. So he said, but it happened in your meditation. She said, I know, but I'm still afraid. And then he told her, so die. What does it mean? That he was being insensitive? No. It was the guru's assurance that nothing will happen. But a process has begun. Let it unfold. Don't get in the way. And of course, it unfolded beautifully. Because after that, she was having this experience of dark clouds coming from the subtle realms, of course, these are not physical. And then this whole beam of light shot up from her belly and expelled the dark clouds. And so what she had to integrate with that experience was over and done with and on to the next. See, that is why people look down upon the path of Kundalini, saying, oh, these are only experiences which come and go. They are right, because mostly people get hooked onto these experiences. They don't see the process through. They don't see the rainbow body. They don't see what happens at death in the subtle realms, how the body dissolves, how the vasanas and sanskaras, the ball of the yin-yang moves forward. Because they do get hooked onto the experiences. But when you rest in witness consciousness and view it like a movie, you allow the movie to reach the end, you know. You don't stop it after 80%. People want to stop it. And then judge the movie based on what they've seen. So again, in her case, it was smooth, barring these small things. And that is what she has given as her message. That the Kundalini is a guide to be nurtured, venerated, loved and trusted. And so, I hope the generations to come will realize this, that there is a new way to look at this experience, to see her journey, her unfolding, what insights it gave her. Rather than going on the net and reading all negative things and then being obsessed with that. You see, because we love negative things, because we are afraid to die. We are fear-based. So, thankfully, all my guides have not been fear-based. That is a big gift. The other thing is attending her own classes, the meditations which physically were conducted here up till the pandemic. Then it went on to Zoom. I learned so much because her audience is quite different from the Advaita audience. A lot of them have these gifts. They have experiences, they have visions, or they are sensitive to energy, sensitive to their surroundings. Yet, the human condition is the same. They have the same issues and same problems we all have. So, once a week that all came onto the table. So, I learned so much. I learned to look at the same things. You see, there are only three main problems in life. Health, money and relationships. Everyone faces these. That is the journey of life. And so they also brought the same issues to the table, but their path was this. So I picked up so much, I got so many insights from this audience, where I felt that even where it was not my own personal experience, I already knew what they would ask and what the answer would be. And that helped me when people come to satsangs here and they have similar experiences, although they are on the path of Advaita. You see, ultimately it's all one. Ultimately it's all one. But this body of people's experiences which got presented to me through my mother's group, her teachings, her books, became a big, for me, a big well to dip into. If I was asked a question, I have never not been able to answer a question. And I don't mean it in an arrogant way. What I mean is that the answer just comes. Because it's not coming from the mind. It's coming from this, almost this whole body of absorbing, imbibing, understanding, conditioning. And so it kind of, I feel what is meant to come, comes. It does not perhaps answer the question all the time, but answers the questioner. And so that is why I'm very open to talking about whatever little bit I know besides Advaita, as far as energy work is concerned, based on my thoughts and feelings about it.
How is the experience of bringing out the book of these sketches that you have spoken so?
Oh, it was fun. Because we had an amazing time. By we, I mean, in my advertising days, I knew art directors, creative directors. Then my mother's disciple, Rohit Arya, he was at that time a journalist and a writer. So we edited some books together. It was really pure entertainment. I mean, at that age, I called it entertainment. But it was for me a spiritual celebration of sorts to every time work on her books, because it was all oriented towards her drawings. And then Rohit brought in, because he has such a vast knowledge of the mythologies of various cultures and all that, so he brought in all these different dimensions to her experiences. And some are very occult experiences, seeing the Emerald Cross, seeing the church bell, which is the Sahasrar Chakra, seeing rays of light, which are actually the Vishnu mark, which people wear, the Vaishnavites. It's actually light traveling in that direction in the subtle realm. So it was really, I was astounded at the symbology behind what we take for granted. That was for me a very big learning. It was really an eye-opener. That especially in Hinduism, because that's what we are familiar with, everything has a meaning. But to us, we were Western educated, Jesuit schools and all, we were taught to look down upon all this, and we thought it was cool to look down upon this. But it is a deep science. The science of chakras, the nadis, the subtle bodies, the koshas, the tattvas. It's really fascinating.
Would you be able to say more about the picture next to you?
This is one of my mother's most famous drawings. It is the surrender to the Guru. And it's not just a creative expression. It is what she actually saw, this blast of light between the feet of the Guru and the folded hands of the disciple. So when we are told that when you bow down, you're offering your ego, that is the common interpretation, at the feet of the source, not of an individual. The individual in the manifest world is representing the source. So we just, it comes naturally to us Indians to do pranam and bow down and all. But she saw that when the surrender happened, she actually saw this explosion of light. And you see, they all swirls and all in this. It all is subtle. You can call it what you will, the cosmic womb, the flow of energy, the swirls. But she actually saw what we can't see with physical eyes of what transpires when there is total surrender. It is actually at the subtle level, it is an explosion of light. So these are not just pretty creative concepts rendered by an artist on paper. It is an actual experience.
There's also some others here behind me that you can see. And there's a picture that's titled Meditation Among the Stars.
That's all, I mean, these are all part of the awakening, you know, the thread of stars. Now, this is around everyone. Sutratma, it's called. And the stars, each chakra has a star on it. So she saw this. Then she saw the rivers flowing within, one going up, one going down. She saw the fire around the Guru's body. It's quite spectacular. I mean, someone might get scared looking at that, you know. The fire of knowledge, the wheel of time, floating above the wheel of time in the galaxy. Then the crystal shivling here with full awakening when the Kundalini rises. The crystal shivling. So really it's the explosion of light from the spiritual heart on the right side of the chest. It's really incredible. I only know two people who have spoken about the spiritual heart. One is Ramana Maharshi and one is my mother. Of course, differently, because his perspective was different. Hers was from actually having that vision of what transpires. But Ramana Maharshi, I mean, her experience was validated by what he spoke about the spiritual heart, which many people could not understand. Even Nisargadatta Maharaj said, it has not been my experience.
Could you say more about the spiritual heart?
That, I think, should be left to my mother and Ramana Maharshi, because I have not had the experience.
Okay. So it sounds like a lot of this sort of knowing what is happening has come after the happening for you and for Santosh Ma.
I suppose so, you could say that.
Like understanding the experience with frameworks that are available to us in the world has...
Actually, for her it clearly happened after, like she would have the experience, not know what it's about. I mentioned this before, this there used to be India's only spiritual bookstore nearby, Chetana bookstore. She would go in there, and as she was walking, she would hear a buzz, zzz, like that. And if she would go towards one bookshelf, it would get louder, another lesser. So she would follow the noise till it got amplified. And then she would run her finger past the books till it got louder and louder and the loudest. And when the noise stopped, her finger stopped, she pulled that book out and found what masters from before had said about what she saw. But they had not seen it, but they knew it. See, hers was a visual experience. All experiences are not visual. It doesn't mean they didn't have the experience. So they wrote about it. So then that is how she realized that what she saw, there is actually being seen and it means something. Then based on that own understanding, as she said, it took 16 years for her to assimilate what happened. And once again, we want quick fixes. We are not willing to give our lifetime to the spiritual journey. We want to get there fast.
Could you speak about the Kundalini trilogy, the book, the books you published?
You see, it was one diary, start to finish, but it was voluminous. I think over 350 drawings. So we had to split it into three books. So we called one Kundalini, A Gentle Force, Kundalini Diary, Kundalini Awakening. And they were all in color because black and white would not do justice to them because the visions are in color. So in terms of just finance and cost, we had to go this way. And then in addition to the trilogy was her independent books of like questions and answers of people. They've asked about their experiences. She has answered them. So that was Kundalini Meditation, Volume 1 and 2. Then she wrote her version of the breathwork course with her guru's blessings, because the original course did not talk about Kundalini and chakras. It was presented in the West. So it was very clinical. But she saw what happened in the subtle body with the same breathwork. So she brought in this aspect to the breaths. So she got her own book out called The Eight Spiritual Breaths. It's the same course, but the insights are different. Then we brought out her autobiography, Mahashakti Awakes. So that's, and her book, Who Am I, which is one of the more popular ones, which is the eternal question, but unraveled through visions. So they are the same visions from the trilogy, selected. which gave her the answer to this question, who am I and where do I come from? You see, her pivot was one sentence in an affirmation. The riddle of the universe is about me and I am now solving it. So as she says, her sadhana became to solve this riddle. Which riddle? The riddle of the universe is about me and I am now solving it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.